No, not a man, not a human being. I'm a complex space-time event. I'm a Lord President of Gallifrey, the traveler from beyond time. I am the Sandman, the oncoming storm. I am the destroyer of worlds, and sometimes, only sometimes, I am your worst nightmare. I am the Doctor, and I take care of my friends. I'm Chris Bivey.
And I am Eddie Webb.
And today on Genreless, we cover an entire era of Doctor Who called the Wilderness Years, years. To start us off, we're going to go ahead and stay up front. This episode is not going to be like any other episode of Genreless that we've done to date at time of recording.
Yeah, it's going to be more talking about the history of a time period of media rather than a specific chunk of media, just because this is a very weird part of Doctor Who, but also, much like everything else talked about, has been super influential on the current Doctor Who, so we can't really skip over it.
Because when Doctor Who went off the air around in, I think it was 89 off the top of my head, didn't come back to 2005, there was an entire period of random fan-made productions of spin-offs, audio adventures, books, the BBC stepping back in to steal the books back from other companies when they realized there's money in it. There were Child in Need, Red Nose specials, I think is what they're called over there. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of stuff for us to touch on. And I wanted to ensure that we got a highlight of it. And I may have surprised some of this on my co-host this morning, because as always, I did a lot of work last night when Eddie was sleeping, because that's what any normal person would do at that point in time. And I'm like, no, I'll add this in. No, I'll add this. No, let's take this out. And I realized as I was cackling to myself, I sounded like the master and I had to take a step back.
Although it is an indication of our friendship that this morning I looked at this, I was like, oh, I know all of these things. I may not watched or read all of them, but I am familiar with all of them. So, I mean, it shows that we're two gentlemen of an age.
Well, there's also the thing that I knew, and our fans may not know, is that Eddie spends a lot of his free time when he's not making awesome materials and creating things, just reading about the history of Doctor Who like some weirdo. I mean, like the most obscure book about the production and where the wood from the TARDIS came from, the shade of paint that the TARDIS is. That is a level of geek that even I do not possess.
I mean, you're kind of making fun of me, but also I literally have an entire magazine devoted to the spin-off comics that were done during Hartnell's run that no one acknowledges as being canon, and the interviews with the people who wrote those and the artists and whatnot, it's a whole lot. But that information has actually helped me for some of the context of what we're going to talk about here. And I want to say, go ahead.
In this massive collection, I need to know if you have this one obscure gem that is almost impossible to find.
Which is?
Lenny Henry's Red Nose, like Children in Need comic book that they put out.
No, I actually don't know what that is. That's actually more obscure than used to.
A bunch of copyrighted IPs from other people. So they did one print run and it has not been reprinted. I want to say it was in 1995, maybe. I've got to remember the name of it, but it came out. It was like Lenny Henry, I want to say, as a doctor running around, and they had other people coming in. It was a massive comic, and they did one run, and it was farcical.
Well, so that's actually a nice segue into the other thing I was going to talk about, but let me briefly sidestep and say, for me at least, this era also is weirdly nostalgic for me, because being an American fan, I couldn't get access to a lot of this stuff initially, except for some very shady roots. So this was always kind of like, I knew Doctor Who was going on in some way, form, or fashion that I didn't have access to. So it was always kind of exciting to know these things existing. But part of the reason why this era happens, and we will describe it in more detail, but part of the reason why this happened is because of two things. One, due to Terry Nation, copyright around certain aspects of Doctor Who scripts have always been a bit weird until 2005. And basically boils down to Terry Nation's agents way back in the day struck out a bunch of clauses where the BBC tried to claim ownership of anything that he produced for the episodes. They struck out those clauses in the contract. The BBC did not see that, signed the contract. He went off to make a whole bunch of Dalek stuff that had nothing to do with the BBC that he got money for. And other writers basically said, I want that deal. So a lot of Doctor Who adjacent stuff, like Lethbridge Stewart, for example, is actually in the hands of the original creators, and so people can make spinoff stuff of that. And the other thing is that the BBC has had a very interesting relationship with charity work. So the comic book you're talking about, as long as Doctor Who adjacent stuff is produced for charity and produced, the constructions that I understand are produced for charity in a limited print run or time availability, they can use protected Doctor Who terminology. So for example, I now own three anthologies called the Forgotten Lives anthologies, which is, and this is peak obscure shit. They wrote three anthologies about the eight faces you see of pre-Hartnell doctors in 5 seconds of the Brain of Morbius. They wrote short stories about each of those incarnations over the course of three anthologies and gave them entire like continuities and regenerations and interconnected stories. But the reason they were able to do that was because all of the money went to Scottish food banks. Awesome. And so basically the website, Obverse Books, who does them, basically said, we can only offer this for a month as part of a charity drive. And then once, and so they're gone from the website. Now you can't get them anymore. So there are a lot of these obscure charity things that have weirdly been influential in a variety of ways on Doctor Who. So the fact that people can do television stuff show that was both licensed and unlicensed for so long is a weird, interesting media chunk of the world.
Thank you. That I set me up for the next piece that I want to touch briefly on. And I'm going to start now. There is, of course, always drama related to anything Doctor Who. And I'm going to keep this very brief and make a statement up front. We have no intention of talking about any of the products created by the BBV Publications and Billy Bragg. Mm-hmm. There is a larger controversy around hiring alleged, because I don't know if it was verified or not,
child pornographer.
Thank you.
I'll say it. He hired an alleged child pornographer and fuck that guy.
and it's abhorrent. And that even more so, I can't express how abhorrent it is. Even as a parent, I have even more hate than I already have for it. Mm-hmm. Amongst the use of other people's IPs that they don't have legal use of, not mm-hmm. paying people for the work they've done. I think I read somewhere in an interview that Colin Baker was never paid for a series that this company made that was basically the Doctor, because they even mm-hmm. had Nicola Bryant in a role as yep. Miss Brown.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to talk about any of their work, because that is a shit person if they do that.
Luckily, there's a whole lot of other stuff to talk about in this time period, so don't even have to talk about it anymore.
So I wanted to get that up front before we moved on to the fun stuff.
Yes. But that's a nice segue in the sense of what was happening and that other companies were also doing at this time was fan productions. They were able to make fan productions of things that were either stripping out very thinly legal protections of who this character, the Doctor, is, and often hiring the same actors to portray extremely similar characters, or actually going back to the writers who made these characters in TV series and giving their consent to use things like Santarans or Draconians, or no one had the money to pay Terry Nation for Daleks, but you know, our favorite writer who created the Santarans definitely loved to get a little extra cash here and there. So you get these weird cases of things that if you only have to squint a little bit to fit it into Doctor Who continuity, but they weren't always necessarily on, you know, official Doctor Who stuff. And then simultaneously, the BBC is also like, well, we've canceled this thing, but we still have a license for it. And we do know that licensed stuff sells. So they were interested in also separately continuing to license stuff. So even though the show is canceled, things like official VHS tapes came out and documentaries came out and whatnot. So there's a lot to cover, but there are basically two rough threads, which are fan unofficial licensed stuff that, or say, unofficially licensed from the BBC, but perhaps licensed from other people. And then officially licensed stuff from BBC Worldwide, which is a separate division. That's a whole separate issue I'm not going to get into. But BBC Worldwide was a separate company, actually Doctor Who officially licensed stuff by several different companies throughout this time period until 2005.
And so before we step properly into all the re-releases and everything else, I do want to take a step back to the end of season 26, okay. Which when we had the Doctor give the amazing speech, they're stepping off screen. There is actually already in the works before that happened, a season 27 in mind with a slew of episodes like, I think it was Earth Aid, Alien, and some other series. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'll say Thin Ice. Yeah. Are you talking about the serials or are you talking about the shows?
I was talking about the shows.
Oh, sorry.
Because I think they had scripted out to have, was it 14 episodes over four episodes? 14 episodes over four shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had some additional ones for the follow-on season, but most of the thought had been put into that first season. And that's where you would have had Ace leave to go to the Prydonian Academy and basically become a time agent. You would have eventually had McCoy regenerate in, I want to say, season 28 is where they had aimed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was some brilliant stuff that they're preparing to do. I think some of them actually became audio adventures later, which I have not heard yet. It's on my to-listen list.
So we're jumping ahead slightly, but Big Finish is a company we're going to talk about a lot about the next period of time. But one of the things they did is they got access to a wide variety of unproduced scripts through all the eras, but primarily two big ones are the season 20, I forgot the name of the number of it, the one where they got scrapped to Big Travel Time, what, 24? No, 23. One of those. The scene that got scrapped to make Travel Time Lord, there was a bunch of scripts already commissioned. Those were in an entire season of audio adventures. And then, the various kind of season 27, 28 scripts, which some of them were just outlines, were also done. And so that entire range is called The Lost Stories. It is now, they're still making them, but it's now getting into the weeds of, now we're going to do a version of Revenge of the Daleks that was an earlier draft of the script. So it's
it loses something at that point.
Yeah, they're running out of material. And also, arguably, they have since also produced some scripts that maybe should have been forgotten because they're really bad for both quality and offensive reasons.
Yeah.
So, but for our purposes, yes, they actually brought Andrew Cartmell back to kind of act as script editor for that run of Lost Ideas. So it's kind of a quasi-official season 27. And one of the ideas was that the next companion is going to be a cat burglar.
Which worked through multiple iterations. Yeah. And it was through sort of multiple iterations, and it was always coming back to be a cat burglar. One of the things I did like is that the Doctor met the parents of the character first, and then later met the in one script version, he helped birth the kid and met her later, which if you go and read up on some of those scripts and what they're supposed to have been or listen to them, you see the similarities that were then taken by later showrunners and used.
Oh yeah.
From the cat burglar iteration, you almost get a parallel of what the Dr. Amy Pond relationship is.
Right. One of my favorite little bits of this era is one of the people that submitted a script during this time period that Andrew Cartmell rejected was a young, scrappy little television writer by the name of Russell Davies. And the advice that Andrew Cartmell gave him was focus more on the family of the people you're talking about. And clearly Russell took that fucking advice to heart.
I hope he's sending Andrew Cartmell a check every so often just as a thank you. It's like, hey, remember the advice you gave me? Here's like £1,000.
Right.
It's nothing to me now. There you go.
Yes. It's what shows you that, like, obviously our conceit has always been, especially during the McCoy run, is that there's a thematic line from the end of the classic series to the beginning of the new series. But I mean, the reality is that a lot of the people that were working through the so-called wilderness years, some of them fell away, but some of them ended up being extremely influential and in many ways directly influential, as in writing for and working on the new series. So there is a very strong continuity between mm-hmm. what happens in 89 and what happened in 2005.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons I did want to touch on the season 27 is that so much of that has now, I'm not going to say been strip mined, but lots of bits of it were used to create the later iterations of the show. To mm-hmm. show, once again, how important the Cartmell master plan was to build the foundation of the old new Who. Mm-hmm. And we can see in a couple of months how it influences the new Who.
New, yeah.
But I want to move on. Is there any last bit you want to talk about season 27?
Nope, that was pretty much it.
Because we've got a lot of time, a lot of years to cover, and I'm trying to do it at more of a pace than I'm prone to.
Right.
So once the show was canceled, what they did is then they proceeded to re-release the episodes on DVDs, and Target Books would also
VHS. Release.
Oh, thank you.
We're not DVDs yet.
I jumped ahead. And Target Books is releasing novelized versions of the show, how it had been for a good chunk of time. And then annually they would do repeat transmissions of the series. And they were still noticing that even repeat transmissions were getting millions of views for a show mm-hmm. they had canceled. And I want to take a beat to say that the repeat transmission continued, I want to say, all the way up to the new series started. And it still got solid viewing for that entire time period.
Right. And one of the things that I know I mentioned much earlier on, but it's worth kind of reiterating at this point in time, is that we're not quite to an era of cable or satellite television yet. England, or the UK at this time, still has, I want to say, 5 or 6 channels, television channels, right? I know ITV is now a thing. Sky's not yet exist. I believe Channel 4 may have broken off from the BBC at this point. I'm not 100% certain on that. But the idea is that if Doctor Who comes back, it's getting millions of views, yes. Some of that is because people are excited to see Doctor Who, want to keep seeing it on TV. Some of that is people have been trained over decades to go, oh, Doctor Who is a thing I watch on TV. So there's an interesting cultural nuance here, because Doctor Who is not cult television. It's throughout what we're going to talk about, we'll see an attempt to try to shove it into that box. But Doctor Who is just television. The only thing that's roughly equivalent, it hasn't happened yet in our timeline, but will very shortly, which is Star Trek. No, it has happened. Sorry. Is Star Trek Next Generation. Star Trek Next Generation was just broadcast television for the US for a long time. It's the reason why a lot of people who don't consider themselves sci-fi fans will still talk about Star Trek in the same way they talk about Star Wars. So Doctor Who is a British staple still, even though it's been canceled.
I like that. And so at around 91, Virgin Books got the license to be able to publish Doctor Who stories for new adventures. So they would carry on with the Seventh Doctor in a brand new sphere of books. And they had this license for about 9 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And during this point in time, they continued the Doctor's adventures with Ace. They introduced new companions like Benny, who we'll talk about shortly. Mm-hmm. And the subject matter was more mature, and it became somewhat more graphic and violence and sex and everything else. And in short, it's what a later iteration of the show with a spinoff, Torchwood, tried to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the word tried purposely.
Well, yeah. The mandate was, I believe that the tagline was, stories are too big for the small screen. So the idea was that, listen, Doctor Who's not really being watched by kids anymore. The people who want more like Christoph aren't going to be children. So let's refocus towards an adult market. And there are, one of the things that's interesting about media is that there are two kind of rough definitions of what adult means. Which is both more complicated, nuanced, and psychological storytelling, and also pornography. Yeah. And a lot of times people muddle what those means, and boy howdy does the New Adventure really land on both sides of the divide of what the word adult means.
And so they kicked it off with started off with a series of four for the quartet of four books. And it started in prehistoric times with like a spaceship landing, and it went from there. The one that we're going to focus on more, it took them a while to find their footing, because the first few books are different tries, and you get to like the trilogy of the Cat's Cradle stuff. And they end up finding the right voice around book 9 with Love and War. But all the books up to this point were still successful. People were buying them, and they were increasing the frequency of the books. It almost became like a monthly print run eventually.
Yeah, yeah. Oh God, Time War Genesis is so awful. But I mean, it's okay. So Time War, real quickly, Time War Genesis is basically Doctor Who finds Gilgamesh, which sounds like a cool concept, right? Except for there's a lot of, well, things were different back then. And so, you know, if King Gilgamesh sexually assaults Ace, that's just a time period, Ace, and you should accept that. It was really not good. So it's not starting off on a great footing. But what's kind of happening in those first 8 books, as you say, is it's the Virgin trying to go, okay, what can't we do? What's not going to work? And so that wasn't the intention, but really it's the, let's try this. Okay, this part of that worked, this part of it didn't. Let's do that. And over time, the line editor starts to put down a set of rules for what writers can and can't do for these Virgin books.
Absolutely. And then that young, scrappy Paul Cornell comes in with Love and War. I'm going to read you a little snippet from this one, sort of the back cover almost. It tries to suck you into it. And this is pulled from the audio version that I listened to because I didn't have time to reread the book. I broke out my copy of the book.
That's all.
I own the entire line of Virgin books. Because a young kid in Alabama in the early 90s trying to get Doctor Who meant, much how Eddie alluded to earlier, going to some shady places, paying a lot of money to get one slim paperback book to be sent to you in the States. Yep. And then I had to keep, and they're all in pristine condition. I kept them like as neat as possible. I move them from house to house when I move. I put them on a place on a shelf. So when people come in, they see them and go, what are those? And I go, oh my friend, let me tell you about the journey it took to get these books. But since I think Eddie's heard part of that story, I won't bore him again. So Doctor Who, Love and War. On a planet called Heaven, all hell is breaking loose. Heaven is a cemetery for both human and draconians, a final resting place for those lost during wartime. The Doctor arrives on a trivial mission, to find a book, or so he says. An Ace wandering around Joycetown becomes involved with a charismatic traveler called Jan. But the Doctor is strenuously opposed to the romance. What is he trying to prevent? Is he planning some more deadly game connected with the coffins revered by a mysterious church of the vacuum and the unusual arch that marks the location of a secret building below ground? Archaeologist Bernice Summerfield thinks so. Her destiny is linked with that of the Doctor, but even she may not be able to save Ace from the Time Lord's plans. This time, has the Doctor gone too far?
Dun, dun, dun. Love and War. Man, there's so much to talk about, but I kind of want to start with how 90s it is, in the sense that one of the plot points is the travelers are also computer hackers, because that's what you do. And they go into this virtual reality called Pewter Space, because lopping off the first syllable of words is cool. And it's like the most 90s cyberspace nonsense. And it's glorious because in computer space, it turns out you can literally ascend to become a multigendered god.
You didn't know that? That's given. Stephen King, I think, wrote about that, didn't he? And it's,
yes.
And if you want to see it, there's a movie with Pierce Brosnan starring in it. And I want to say there's even a sequel to it, too.
Is Pierce Brosnan Lawnmower Man?
Yeah.
I know there's a sequel. I just didn't know. I don't know if he's in the sequel,
but I know he's in the first one.
I know the sequel went directly to home video, so tells you everything you need to know.
And so I listened to this audio adventure. I read it when it originally came out. I have not read it since. And I stand by, Benny is the best character in the world.
Yes.
I love Benny. And Benny came out, I want to say, before Laura Croft did. So it makes me wonder if the people that made Laura Croft read Love and War. And then when...
Maybe. I do know that she was directly influential to River Song, who's another... female futuristic archaeologist. So,
slash thief.
Right. So there's a lot of connection there. But so Benny is the first non-television companion. And because the version books were licensed, therefore she is officially a companion. In certain definitions of canon, which we've already debated and then we'll not go into again. But Benny has been around off and on for decades now. She has her own ongoing audio series. When Virgin Books lost license, which we'll get to, Bernice went on to continue doing the adventures in this continuity. So, I mean, she is the most influential character, most influential companion that has never been on television out there. And hilariously, played by the actor who played the cheetah person in Survival we just saw. Lisa Bowerman. Yes. So good.
Too much of the same knowledge.
Yes. But yeah, no. So Love and War, you're right. Paul Cornell kind of finds the synthesis path forward for the new adventures and finds a way to, because one of the things that, about Benny that was transgressive at the time is that she is the opposite of Ace. She's a woman with lots of lived experience. She drinks. She has sex. She's very blunt about her needs as a woman. She's very sex positive, as we call it now.
Love it.
But it's never portrayed as as negative qualities. This is just who she is. She's just a younger woman. Says she's in her 30s. She's not middle-aged, but certainly has more experience than Ace. And also, we'll call the Doctor on his bullshit, which is another trope that we start to see more of in the modern era of Doctor Who, is companions who can stand up against the Doctor. Benny, Ace starts to do it, as we talked about in Survival, but Benny's really the first companion who straight up will call the Doctor on his nonsense.
And so I will also point out, I think that a lot of Captain Jack is based on this interpretation of Benny too.
Mm-hmm.
But to go into the plot itself, I want to say the plot is rubbish. I love everything around it, but it undead mushroom people.
Right.
Equivalently.
But that's one of the things that Paul Cornell does, I think, is actually groundbreaking for the new adventures, is that Paul Cornell realizes that the plot doesn't matter. A lot of the previous books tried to make the plot matter, and they've kind of fall apart because when your plot is the TARDIS has gone insane and has manifested that insanity as a sentient cat, time-traveling cat, you're running aground with some real problems here. Paul Cornell is like, no, it's all about vibes. If you have really interesting characters you want to read about and a fun mystery, then the details almost don't matter. And
he's right.
You're right, because Love and War is nonsense, but ultimately it's about what exactly the title says. It's about trying to find love and dealing with the wartime environment. And so Benny and Ace fill those two categories. Ace falls in love, and that's a big point of contention. while Benny is trying to recover from having escaped from a war and what that has done to her, and the doctor is being mysterious in the background because that's the Virgin Era doctor. Yeah.
And it also touches back on some things that we saw during the season 26-25, where he writes notes for himself and leaves them to help him solve the current situation. And then you get him saying, I have to remember later to do this for myself. So it's reinforcing that thing about him going through different time periods. But I want to take a step back and highlight, we keep saying Paul Cornell's name. And if you think, how do I know Paul Cornell? I haven't read any of his books. That's because if you're a old New Who fan, you would have seen, potentially seen, one of Paul Cornell's novels turn into the television version called Human Nature.
Mm-hmm. Right. Human Nature.
The 10th Doctor instead of the 7th Doctor in Benny.
Right. Yeah. So if you saw the two-parter of Human Nature in the 10th Doctor era, basically it's the 7th Doctor and Benny versus 10th Doctor and Martha. The plot's surprisingly similar to the novel because that shows you how influential these novels were. I mean, to be blunt, Russell T. Davies wrote one of these novels, right? So, I mean, that's how muddy the waters are at this point. And, but the people who either went on to write, the people who went on to write the, and produce the show either wrote for this line or fans of this line or both. So the Virgin books, it really can't be overstated how influential they were for Doctor Who. And the other thing is also they openly and repeatedly said in the burgeoning Usenet communities is that as far as they knew, they were writing Doctor Who, right? They felt they genuinely were continuing the TV show. So the TV show was canon. Their
and
adventures
as long
canon.
As certain people were in the BBC, they were.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Right. That will change because no licensee ultimately has that authority. But there was this weird period where no one was telling them they were wrong.
And before we go too far on, this is one of the few times I will say that having the 10th Doctor and Martha be in the Human Nature story, I enjoyed more than I did the 7th Doctor and Benny. Because Martha's character stuck in that time period, that point in time, adds an additional layer of complexity that cannot be had with Benny and the Doctor.
Right. Yeah. I've read Human Nature relatively recently, and it's still a good book. Don't get me wrong. But A, you're right. Martha's historical context makes that story resonate better, and B, also the Chameleon Arch thing is completely invented for the TV show and then goes on to have additional resonances. Whereas for this one, the plot device is basically the Doctor's having a sulk and decides he doesn't want to be a Time Lord for a while. And Benny ultimately talks him out of it. And he goes, okay, maybe I need to get back to be a Time Lord, and moves on. There are stakes in the story, but the stakes are intentionally low rent. Again, it's important. Paul Cornell's great leads, because like how we got here and how we leave don't matter. What we do over here matters, and that's what makes the novel great. But the fact that Russell T. Davies can then say, but also how we got here and how we leave do matter. So if you add that on there, well, then you have even more depth. So, I mean, I agree that this is the one place where the adaptation is actually a bit better, but that doesn't diminish from Human Nature as a novel.
And a lot of the gravitas and everything else that we get from the Doctor going forward comes from this line. Like, the 7th Doctor becomes Time's champion. He gets all these names, and that legacy is cemented here, which is why later when you see Eccleston try to pull it a little bit, or you get Tennant doing it, or even I can't say Jody. They didn't give Jody a chance to do it. That would have been pretty cool to see. But when they do it, it's because it started here. Like, I cannot stress enough how critical these books in season 25 and 26 were for what we have now.
Right. Mm-hmm. I was just saying, like, there are tiny, tiny references to the novels in the 2005 run, if you look for them. If you ever hear a passing reference to the Chelonians in a bit of dialogue, the Chelonians were absolutely a novel-specific race. They're giant fascist space turtles. That's That's what they are. But it's a throwaway line because it's a little nod towards this novel series. Again, it's the only novel, only spinoff novel that we know of that has been directly adapted to the television show. So it that shows you how much cachet that it has. So I'm completely with Chris. Like, if you actually go and read the novels, there's a lot of garbage because there's like 60 of them, right? Don't get me wrong. But there's about, I'd say offhand, 12 to 15 novels that so clearly contribute to the TV show, and a couple that, boy, how do people wish it did? Look at you, Lungboro.
God, yeah.
but you're right. The evolution of the Doctor to this mythic force, it started in season 26, season 25, ramped up in season 26, but it doesn't really happen until these novels.
And any other comments about that before we move on?
We could do a whole episode on them, but we should move on.
I know. So that's putting us around 92. So we're maybe 2 or 3 years after the show ended. And that's when the Virgin books kick off and they start running at a clip pace. And the BBC then starts releasing some radio dramas also, like The Paradise of Death. I think they had The Third Doctor and Sarah Jane.
Oh, yeah.
And some other little things like that. Mm-hmm. And an anniversary was coming up. So they decided they wanted to do a new special, The Dark Dimension. Eddie, do you know about The Dark Dimension?
Not
Dimensions in Time that it became, but The Dark Dimension.
The hubris behind Dark Dimension is legendary.
Ooh, I think you have more juice than I do. So my understanding of Dark Dimension is that they wanted to have an anniversary special. It was going to feature the Fourth Doctor, an enemy sort of deregenerated him back to an older Fourth Doctor. They're going to have little guest appearances of the other Doctors. And in the end, it didn't happen because John Pertwee and Colin Baker refused to appear with such tiny roles in it. I think there's a quote where Colin Baker says, "I have their script stored in my shredder."
Yep.
Because it was supposed to have been highlighted Tom Baker as a Doctor again.
Right, yeah. That's what I meant by hubris, was that they're like, we're going to bring every single living actor who's played the Doctor, put them all together into this 125-minute episode, and it'll be fine. And it was not fine. Also, from what I understand, it was pitched to people with the idea that the actors were on board. And then once they got the green light, they went to the actors to get them on board saying they had the green light. So there were shenanigans involved. But to be honest, I think kind of what really happened here is it was still too soon, right? Like the series only been canceled for 4 years. Tempers were still high. People were still like, Tom Baker held a grudge for decades over how he was removed from the show. Colin Baker was still pretty pissed off at how he was removed from the show. McCoy is famously game for whatever, so that was never an issue.
Well, he was still the Doctor at this point in time.
Right,
there was no Paul McGann yet. He was the Doctor.
And John Pertwee had actually been in some fan things around this time, and in the radio program too. So he was also game for it. So basically, I mean, like, I could see why a bunch of people saying, okay, we know at least that McCoy and Pertwee are on board. We could probably get everybody else on board. And that just wasn't true.
But it's also noted that Pertwee and Colin Baker were the ones that decided, no, that their roles were too small.
Right.
Since they were giving everything basically to Tom. And instead, with a precious little time left, J&T, this is the last time you'll hear us say J&T's name, made Dimensions in Time happen, which takes all the Doctors and companions that are willing to come back, put them in a blender, and pour them over Coronation Street. Sorry, EastEnders.
Thank you.
I caught myself. Over EastEnders. In a shopping market, being opposed by the Ronnie. And for anyone that is enjoying the new version of All Creatures Great and Small, you may see an actor from there as her companion. I am purposely being vague because I can see any face now.
I actually don't know because I've never seen this.
I recognize him by his voice and because he's super clean shaven in Dimensions in Time, but not in All Creatures Great and Small. There you go. I gave a big, big clue because only one person really has facial hair in that show.
I still don't know. I'm definitely
you need to watch All Creatures Great and Small.
Clearly.
It's like sitting under a warm blanket with a good cup of tea.
Fair enough.
And you, as the owner of a dog, will like it even more because they have a dog that lives with them. But it's a show about vets in like late 30s, early 40s Europe, taking care of animals. And Ziggy keeps looking up at the screen when the horses come on. And she goes, "You're just a big dog." It's like, no, that's not a dog.
I mean, it does sound like a show I would love to watch. Although my only contribution, honestly, is that this is hilariously not the first time EastEnders has had a weird sci-fi connection, because also EastEnders eventually ends up having a regular ongoing character played by the same actor who played Dave Lister in Red Dwarf.
Yeah. Charles Craig.
Which became a plot point during one of the Red Dwarf revival series.
I don't see enough of Charles Craig.
Charles Craig is amazing.
Do you want to talk about any more Dimension in Time? I've given enough time because I'm not even going to talk about the outfit they put Leela in, the fact that they have Leela and the Seventh Doctor running around. They mixed up all the companions together, that it makes no sense. It is like the Star Wars Christmas special, but not as good.
Yeah, honestly, yeah. I mean, it is, it frankly kind of put the nail into the every anniversary must be a multi-doctor thing. The 50th being, I think, kind of the only exception. But, I mean, that's such a huge milestone. I can see why maybe they visited it. But a lot of people have said multi-doctor shows kind of don't work. And Dimensions of Time is kind of one of the reasons why it doesn't. But, yeah, it is definitely on par with the Star Wars Christmas special in terms of how it's viewed now. And the frustrating part is that some people are like, well, it's because it got crossed over I almost got me doing it with EastEnders. But as Russell Davies later proves, Doctor Who and soap opera are much more connected than people give credit for. So the idea is not wrong. Yeah. And if you want to get your show back in public consciousness, pairing it with an extremely popular show, because again, this goes back to my earlier point, Doctor Who was not seen as genre television. It was seen as a British staple. So having two British staples appear on the same screen was not as weird as it sounds to Americans at this time. It was still deeply weird.
So all of that happened around 93. Then as we move into 94, we go back to Virgin Publishing, who had been killing it with their book line, like so successful that they then got a license and permission to start publishing past Doctor New Adventure books.
I want to interject
and
here
that's
briefly.
When they started their What?
I want to check here.
They started their missing it.
Oh, sorry. I think we're a bit delayed here. I want to interject briefly because right before this, the line editor, whose name is Peter Darvill Evans, wrote a novel called Deceit. Well, the New Adventures. It is not a good book unless you want to see Absalom Doc, which is a comic-specific character, get killed. It's not great.
Eddie.
Yes.
You brought it up.
No,
who
we're moving on.
Is Absalom Doc?
Not relevant to this conversation. What's relevant to this conversation, at the end of it, he wrote an epilogue. And the epilogue is interesting for a couple of reasons. One is he said this novel was designed as a way to show future New Adventure writers that the rules we have put in place do result in good drama. Good. And so basically I wrote a book to try to prove my own rules. But the other thing he says is that I will never do a spinoff line featuring the previous doctors. Fast forward to this.
Now I have to stop. Eddie, is Absalom Doc a Dalek killer? So in 94, they then get permission to go and start making a whole line of all the past Doctor books. And they bring in a pitch hitter to sort of not kick it off with. So Paul Cornell comes in and writes I think it's goth opera with the Fifth Doctor, Tegan, and Nyssa to kick off the new line with for the past previous Doctors. And so it starts opera, just jumping.
It's going to be adapted by Big Finish very soon, actually.
I'm going to listen to that one. And so you get more depth into the previous Doctors too, while you still have the New Adventures lines running. So you have New Adventures and the Missing Adventures going on simultaneously, dropping at least one book a month, I think, for each of them, if memory serves.
Mm-hmm. Right. The New Adventures originally were bi-monthly. The New Adventures originally bi-monthly. And then right around the end of Time Worm, or maybe it was around Battle of the War, they were monthly. I know that. Somewhere in there, they came with monthly. And then, yeah, the line writer realized he couldn't do two Seventh Doctor books a month. So that's why they went to the Missing Adventures. So, I mean, you have to understand that. So by this time, Doctor Who was a moneymaker. I mean, it was putting out a novel every 2 weeks, and they were selling reasonably well every time.
And that's when you start hearing the BBC go, what's that noise? And you keep hearing cha-ching. Cha-ching. And the BBC is starting to take notice around now.
Yep.
So anything else about the Missing Adventures before I move on?
Just to say that some of them are really good and deeply weird.
Some of them are really bad.
I've been catching up. My nice thing about living in London is that I can go to things like eBay and charity shops and get this stuff relatively cheap. So I pick up a novel here and there. There's one that introduces another spin-off character that has gone on to have life of her own, which is Iris Wildtime, where she meets the Third Doctor, and that is amazing because she realizes she is a metatextual creation, and so tries to convince the Third Doctor he's not real, which is just an amazing story. But also, there's a Fourth Doctor adventure where he meets up with Sarah Jane later on in her life, and they fight an alien that takes the form of a 90s dot-com corporation. So if you can imagine Tom Baker trying to say things like, I'm dicing with death on the information superhighway, is just ludicrous. So the Missing Adventures are the first real idea that people want to see more of previous incarnations of the Doctor, and also that there are narrative gaps that can be filled with these things, which is important for later on in our story.
But then that touches back to something that we discussed during the Fifth Doctor's run, where it creates problems when the show was so succinct to have like almost all the Fifth Doctor's adventure happen back to back. So then you get little gaps where the Fifth Doctor suddenly, according to the books or the audio dramas, goes away and has 3 years of adventures and comes back. Or right. He's suddenly adventuring with this companion who he just met for an extra year or two, which then detracts some of the drama of the sacrifice he makes to save her.
Right.
So that's all way. So for you fellow creatives and writers, make big gaps in time in all your stories so you can fill it in later.
Yep. Absolutely.
Any other comments about the incredible Missing Adventures?
Some of them have been reprinted, so they're worth kind of tracking down. I know a few of them were reprinted during the 50th anniversary, and ever since then, occasionally they get reprinted. So look around for older Doctor Adventures. You're probably running across either the Missing Adventures or a book that we'll talk about in a minute here. But there were some of them worth tracking down, honestly.
So as we're moving forward, you could say that what I'm about to do should have happened earlier in the run, because I'm going to talk a little bit about Real Time, which is another fan-based company that started making videos and other media for Doctor Who with the license. Because Real Time, I think, was made in 1984 or something before the show itself had even ended. Mm-hmm. But the reason I'm putting it here in our timeline is we're going to talk more detail about Downtime that didn't come out till 1995. There is a big debate between Eddie and myself about which one to do. I wanted to do Wartime, which is horrible, but it's got my man Benton in it. And so I was like, Eddie, let's do Wartime. And he's like, I don't want to watch Wartime. Because Eddie hates Sergeant Benton. Because he likes officers instead of enlisted. So he's that kind of person.
That is absolutely true, in the sense that I never said any of those words.
And so Real Time also had a documentary series called Mythmakers that was hosted by Nick Briggs. So they were engaged, like the fans and some of the crew and everyone else from the show.
Chris, who's Nick Briggs?
I don't know.
No. You pull the suit on me all the time.
Does anyone like Daleks here?
I do.
Then you probably like Nick Briggs. There you go. You give detailed, in-depth histories. I make jokes, and I know the history, but I choose actively not to get
it. Fair enough.
That is our dynamic.
I'll follow on the sword real quick and just say that Nick Briggs, one of the creators behind Big Finish, but more important to our long-term analysis, he has become, frankly, the voice of most of the monsters in the new Doctor Who, but more specifically, the Daleks and the Cybermen. And he is an extremely talented voice actor. And started off by making documentaries with original Doctor Who actors.
I'm very conscious of our dynamic. If I start taking your job, then who's going to make all these bad jokes?
Please take my job.
You would feel bad making these bad jokes. Well, I, on the other hand, do not feel bad. Because you care about our listeners. You're a compassionate human being. I have a cold, black, dead heart. Much like the Master. So anyway, we've got plenty of time and a lot of my 8 pages of notes to go through to get there. I'm surprised you didn't mention all the notes I put on this page. Like that is Eddie right there for you, showing his compassion, his kind heart. Look at how I was right once again.
Four and a half pages.
Because I cut. So. Talking about that, we decided to go with downtime because downtime featured more of the actual companions and companion adjacent people than what wartime did. Wartime was shorter, though. So downtime. Victoria, former Second Doctor companion, is lured back to a monastery in Tibet by a dream telling her that she'd be reunited with her late father there. Instead, the great intelligence possesses Professor Travers has contacted her. Nearly 15 years later, in the present, Victoria is a vice chancellor of New World University. So for 15 years, the great intelligence has possessed this person and has controlled Victoria, forcing her to do this. 15 years, Eddie. New World is an institution claiming to offer spiritual guidance to distraught youth. In reality, New World is a center of operations for the intelligence to conquer Earth by infecting the global computer network. The administration and students await the coming of the New World, heralded by the arrival of the Chancellor, the intelligence-possessed Travers. Victoria's motives are well-meaning but misguided. She was manipulated with a promise of the light of truth. The students themselves have been brainwashed through their computer courses and are enslaved to the intelligence. Outsiders refer to them as chilies. What the fuck? Intelligence needs a final missing locus to attain its goals. It believes it is in the possession of the Brigadier. That's right. They got the Brigadier to come back for this. But it is actually his daughter, Kate, and her grandson, Goddard, on their narrow boat. I'm pausing here just to look at Eddie. A Yeti on a boat, Eddie. A Yeti on a boat. The intelligence needs a final missing... I read that, I don't care. New World attempts to gather information from the Brigadier by requesting an investigation. And Sarah Jane shows up. Sarah lies about her knowledge of the Brigadier and later warns him and UNIT. The intelligence then arranges a meeting between the Brigadier and the corrupt UNIT captain. Throughout the story, the Brigadier is aided by a New World student named Daniel Hinton, a former student from Brendan Public Schools. The intelligence conditioning failed on Hinton, though at the time he's still under its influence, and at one point becomes a Yeti on a boat. He can communicate with the Brigadier through the astral plane.
Right.
This is what Eddie chose for us to watch.
No, that's not how that works. So what? the reason why people point to this is say, look, this is where Kate Lethbridge-Stewart came from. In the sense that there is a woman named Kate who is Lethbridge-Stewart's daughter. The characters are completely different. The actors are completely different. But it shows you to an interesting point in the sense that this stuff was influencing what would come later, right?
I want to say before this, though, in the new adventures, there was a Katrina Lethbridge Stewart that showed up first.
No. I forgot her name.
But you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, because she's actually from Africa. Because there's a really awkward subplot about Lethbridge Stewart sleeping with a native while on one of his missions overseas.
And I want to say that came out before this came out.
Yeah, and there was a whole subplot about how the Lethbridge Stewart line became the protectors of the Earth, and it's not good.
I just want to point out that the first daughter of the Brig was a black woman.
Yeah.
And then they made her white.
Right. And a chav. But what's weird about Downtime is that on the one hand, given the production values and the people involved and the writing involved, you can almost squint and look at this as kind of a Doctor Who episode, right? It's like it from a production standpoint, from a how it's shot, how it the level of budget or lack thereof, you can kind of almost see a Doctor Who episode in this. The problem being that unless you have watched literally decades of Doctor Who, this episode makes not a damn bit of sense. And arguably, yeah, even if you had that knowledge, it still doesn't make a ton of sense.
A Yeti on a boat.
That's...
I can't get past it.
I want to say there's worse in there, but sadly, nothing's coming to mind. There is a brief gag where the Brigadier runs into someone and thinks he's the Doctor again in a legally distinct way. But, like, you literally have to know the subplot of two different Second Doctor adventures and also who Sarah Jane Smith, who Sarah Jane Smith is, and also Margarine Undead, and also Battlefield before any of this stuff even makes sense. It's so clearly a fan thing targeted to fans. So the fact that it's vaguely watchable is somewhat surprising.
I didn't go back to see who wrote it, who acted in it, but I am curious if Daniel Hinton, the actor playing that character, is also the writer. Because I won't lie, if I was going to write myself a fan production, I'd write myself a big part too, where I could hang out with the Brigadier.
Sure, yeah.
And the silver rolling ball.
That is a plot point, my friends.
Oh, God. God.
That is straight out of the series, but it's like, again, it's such a fan thing because, like, we have to be absolutely faithful to this thing in the 60s. It's like, no, it was made 30 years ago. Do a new thing.
And it
Do you want to know who wrote this?
Who?
Mark Platt.
Really?
Yes.
Maybe,
creator of Ghostlights. Your favorite episode. Mark Platt wrote this.
It is a great episode. And so when we go back and we talk about editors, this is why editors are so important.
Yes.
And artistic vision is amazing to have, but you have to understand there's a compromise balance in there.
Yeah.
Because I see how this could have worked. I'm still upset that they basically manipulated Victoria for 15 years and made her kind of a villain for the piece, because I liked Victoria and she's got a raw deal throughout most of her time in the show.
Right. But the other thing that is kind of happening here with real-time pictures on some level is this idea that people who worked on Doctor Who in the past can still maybe not make a living, but make money off of this market specifically to Doctor Who fans. Doctor Who fans are willing to pay money to see things by, from, and featuring the people they loved in Doctor Who, which is radical.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, yes, Mark Platt wrote this. It was directed by someone who directed Doctor Who, which is why it looks a lot like a Doctor Who episode. It features a lot of actors who spent time on Doctor Who. And this is where the trend of now we have things like Leela being in a small little film about the Time War. That's where the seeds of this comes from, the idea that, or even, you know, Tales of the TARDIS, frankly. You know, the fact that there is a market for people who want to see these actors still doing these bits. So real time is showing that there is a market for a television show that's been canceled for things that aren't directly connected to that television show, but still orbit it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wild.
And that's when the BBC went, well, thank you for doing all that hard work for us over these years and showing us there's a new cash stream that we could do. Mm-hmm. So they started talking to the US, who had big bucks, mm-hmm. and the UK had ideas to come up with a beautiful little baby called the Doctor Who TV movie that went through mm-hmm. multiple iterations and scripts. Some of them had the Doctor being related to Ulysses, being half human, an array of different things. And some of those little snippets still made it into the TV movie itself. And to give you an overview of the great movie that introduced the Eighth Doctor and killed my favorite Doctor in the second crappiest way possible, only worse by falling down and bumping your head on the TARDIS console,
yep.
to be gunned down in the street. But that didn't kill him. Like, that would have been, oh, that sucked.
No, the American health system killed him.
The U.S. health system. Like, wait, don't do it. I'm not dead. What the? And I don't mean dead, then regenerate. I mean dead in morgue for untold amount of time to then regenerate. The quick synopsis. The Doctor, nearing the end of his seventh life, is charged with transporting the remains of his fellow Time Lord, now Ashes, the Master, back to their home planet. Because he was given this mandate by the Daleks. Despite his precautions, his old enemy is not only not dead, but is out for revenge, creating a time malfunction in the TARDIS and bringing the Doctor to San Francisco in 1999. I will resist singing Prince, just barely. The Master escapes and puts his plans into motion. The Doctor must find a beryllium atomic clock to stop the Master. But how will he succeed after being shot down by members of a street gang? Bow, 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 and finding true love with Grace, who he then leaves on the planet. Oh, wait. Then he goes back in time and brings everybody back to life.
So,
Superman.
The movie did not kickstart Doctor Who 1996, as we all know. What's hilarious to me is that over time, the things that people were mad about the TV movie doing have been done better in the subsequent reboots of Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah. That kiss. Woo.
Right. Because the idea is Doctor doesn't have that companion with, you know, he doesn't follow his companions. Clearly, that ship has fucking sailed in every sense of ship. But what has hilariously happened is that we're now free to talk about the other reasons why this movie is bad. It's like there are layers of terrible that now that we've remove the silt from the first layer, we now have different levels underneath. It's like, no, this is also bad. This is bad for different reasons.
Do you want to talk about Paul McGann's wig? Is that what you want to talk about?
Paul McGann's wig is a big part. He's notoriously he's talked about. Paul McGann's been very generous by this time in Doctor Who, briefly, though it was. But the wig is one thing he always keeps coming back to.
Because originally, when he auditioned for the role, he was playing some other role from like 18th century where he had long hair, and he auditioned and they liked it. Then he showed up in the U.S., shaved head because he just played like someone in the military, and they're like, dude, what the fuck? Yeah. He's like, come on, I could be the first like shaved doctor, and they're like, no.
And then what happens? Fast forward to Christopher Eccleston.
So I did a smidge of research to come up with this. Do you know, and this is something I didn't know until recently, that his costume is a mix of Wyatt Earp, because they looked at Wyatt Earp and they added on sort of the Victorian sort of frock coat over the Wyatt Earp look.
Yeah. I only know that because that was kind of a joke in subsequent tie-in stuff that no one knew was supposed to be Wyatt Earp. And the Doctor is indignant about the fact that no one recognizes this. It's clearly kind of a gag because they there are so many things that are wrong about the TV movie, and what's frustrating is that it's not usually the reason that people ding it for. Like the TARDIS set, for example, I actually deeply love the TV movie TARDIS set. It's the first time we have a big voluminous TARDIS set that's not just white and rondels, and opens the way for the yes, but opens the way for new interpretations to happen in subsequent shows, yeah. Right? And the kind of very clear, we're going for a Victorian time machine, you know, H.G. Wells vibe was neat. It's sucks because, well, one of the things that sucks, and I hate to say this, is that McCoy didn't need to be in it.
No.
We saw the reboot that, and the reason why McCoy did it was because he knows how Colin got burned. And so he's like, he always said, I will be there for the regeneration scene because I don't want to do what happened. I don't want to be in that place. Even no matter what happens, he said, I will do the regeneration scene. And so they're like, cool, we'll do the regeneration scene. But American audiences have no clue who this old guy is. And then like, okay, this is the character we're following. And then 30 minutes in, he's dead. And now there's this whole new character that we have to follow. From a structural standpoint, it makes no sense.
But the flip side of that is, though, that allowed McCoy to be with McGann for all the interviews. Like, if you go back and look, they did a bunch of interviews together. Mm-hmm. And Paul McGann was really hesitant to be in the role, dealing with everything else. And McCoy gave him a solid foundation to work from.
Yeah.
Like, that is indispensable. I think I agree, McCoy didn't need to be there. But if McCoy wasn't there, I don't think Paul McGann would have come back to Doctor Who at all.
No, that I agree with. And there's a hilarious side note to that, which I'm sure we'll get to in future. But there's a lot of things that are, if you look at the movie just in isolation, that are just wrong and bad about it. But as an artifact of this Wilderness Years era, and that's the reason why we're not covering it in detail, if you look at it as an artifact of this progression of Doctor Who, it's fascinating because so much of what we now know as Doctor Who on some level either comes from or is refined by this TV movie.
Yeah.
And I don't know what anybody else says. I still like the Bruce Master.
The Bruce Master?
Yeah, the master possesses a guy named Bruce. He's now known as the Bruce Master.
Yeah, Eric Roberts. Yeah.
Eric Roberts understood his job, and that's something I will defend, is that it's like, we need someone to chew the scenery and be a megalomaniac villain. He's like, I am on it. And nobody else understood the problem. I mean, Paul McGann sort of understood, but everybody else is like, well, we'll play this like a television drama. And it's like, no, do what Eric Roberts is doing. And that's why it looks weird, because he's the only one doing it.
Hey, Eddie. What? Do you know that I'm half human on my mother's side?
Do you know that Dr. lies?
It doesn't work like that, though, because then the master verifies it later on.
And they need a human.
They need a human's eye to open the eye of harmony that's inside the TARDIS.
Hilariously, there's actually an explanation for that in one of the Big Finish audios, which is just peak fan nerddom.
So after that failed attempt, the BBC went, though, Doctor Who still has money in it, and they reclaimed all the rights, and BBC started making their own BBC version books, and they started with The Eighth Doctor. Virgin Publishing still had a few years left, I think, in some of their IPs for, like, the classic books, and that's when they started to do the big shift over to Binning, taking over their line. But the BBC goes, we're bringing back Doctor Who because there's money in this.
And my favorite moment of this, so I'm going to start by saying that Gareth Roberts is a transphobe, and fuck Gareth Roberts. But the last book that was ever published for the Missing Doctors line, Gareth Roberts wrote A Fourth Doctor Adventures. And the entire story ends with the Doctor they're finally tracked down. This is the Fourth Doctor Romana story. So they're finally tracked down by the Black Guardian. And the Doctor's like, I found a way to escape. And they shove the TARDIS into the land of fiction. And he's like, they'll never find us because now we become fictional characters. And no one can control our destiny from this point forward. And I'm like, okay, that is the biggest fuck you to BBC books. It's like the pettiness of fans sometimes delights me.
Oh, God. All right. So not only did they take that over, but then there was also video games of Doctor Who that started coming out, like Doctor Who, Destiny of the Daleks. Doctor Who, Destiny of the Doctors. I'm not going to go into it. Well, I'm going to keep moving on.
You cannot gloss over the last live action presentation of Anthony Ainley as the Master. Except for the fact that it's terrible and you absolutely should gloss over it.
But he came back. He did it. So now we finally hit, I want to say like 1999, with The Curse of the Fatal Death.
Oh, God.
Another special. It aired in multiple parts, almost like it sort of brought back some of the vibe of Doctor Who. And this would be the first real on television new Doctor Who anyone got, like right now. And so we're going to break it down into the four parts, talk a little bit about it, and then move on. And Eddie's eyes are looking because he thinks we're running long in time. And you know what I say? Time is an irrelevant concept.
Time is a flat circle.
Part one. The Master fails spying on the Doctor and his companion, Emma. The Doctor wants to meet the Master on Tartarus to give him essential news. The Doctor and Emma land in an empty castle on Tartarus, where he explains that the Tarisians were a kindly, peaceful, loving race, but shunned and abhorred due to their communications solely through the practice of modulated farting. They destroyed themselves after discovering fire. The Master and the Doctor play a game of I did it first for a few minutes, with the Master ending up covered in shite and hundreds of years older. Emma interrupts to prompt the Doctor to announce that they're in love, and the Doctor plans to retire from traveling through time and space, having saved every planet in the universe a minimum of 27 times, and settle down in domestic bliss. Horrified and nauseated, the Master threatens his next fatal plan to plunge them into the vast, disgusting sewers of Tartarus, warning them to prepare themselves for 500 miles of fear and feces. End of part one.
In case it's not clear, this is meant to be a parody.
What? Rowan Atkinson as a Doctor is playing this straight, Eddie. He's not making jokes. He is.
That's what's so fascinating about Curse of the Fatal Death is because I kind of want to see a run of Rowan Atkinson as a Doctor, right? I mean, he's known as a comedian, but one of the things that is fascinating about comedians is that comedians, because of their need to understand timing, usually end up being very good dramatic actors as a result. Yes. And so we have Rowan Atkinson, who's in on the joke, and he's trying to play something of a kind of 70s era doctors, like kind of a Tom Baker-ish, kind of a John Pertwee-ish doctor. But he's doing it in a way that's extremely plausible. Like this, you could see this being kind of a missing incarnation of the Doctor in a lot of ways, which is a gag that we'll get to in a minute.
He feels very much like the Blackadder from the World War One or Two version of it.
Right, right. The one who's actually competent and everyone else is an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the earliest incarnation where he's an idiot and everyone else is also competent. So this is the again, and that's the gag, is like he's married to his companion, so it's kind of a rib on the TV movie in that regard. And the time travel, I'm going to go back in time and do this, I'm going to go back in time before you and do this, is weirdly something that doesn't actually happen in Classic Doctor Who, but will happen because the person who wrote this is fucking Stephen Moffat. Who basically took Curse of Fatal Death, made an entire season out of it in Love the Doctor era, and called it a story.
That's correct, because you can hear some of the lines that are said in this episode appear later throughout the run of Doctor Who, little snippets here and there. Literally, you know what? I got writer's block. I'm going to pull this thing that I've already done and put it back up on the screen.
Right. And, you know, Emma's meant to be kind of the unfortunate stereotype of the female companion, very much in the Perry school. So that's a little annoying. But again, like everyone in this thing gets the joke, and everyone in this thing loves Doctor Who, clearly. This is a Perry that only people who deeply love the thing you're making fun of can really do.
Any other comments on this? Nothing about 500 miles of fear and feces?
That's everyday life, man.
Part two. When the Master pulls the lever, He's been outsmarted yet again by the Doctor and falls into the pit. The Master appears later, significantly older and with the Daleks, the only creatures not repulsed by the Master's smell, having no noses. The Master boasts his body has been augmented by Dalek technology. He now has a plunger in place of his right hand, though Emma quickly figures out that he doesn't know what to do with it. The Master tries to strangle the Doctor and falls down the same pit again and returns hundreds of years later for him. The Doctor, the Daleks pursue the Doctor and Emma through numerous corridors that look very similar. Still, one Dalek accidentally bumps to the Master, causing him to fall through the trap door yet again. An extremely old Master then walks into view, complaining about having spent 936 years in a sewer. The Doctor and Emma find what they believe to be the way out of the castle, but it turns out to be a room full of Daleks in part two.
Okay. The Master continually falling through a hole in the floor is the cheapest humor possible, and I still laugh hysterically every single time. Because is the perfect example of, okay, this joke's getting a bit thin, but if you keep doing it, it wraps around to being funny again.
I never wanted to watch Doctor Who do Scooby-Doo. And that is literally what this is for me.
Right, right. It's, I mean, of the four parts, this is definitely the one that is the more kind of traditional British humor, sitcom-y style humor. This is the one that requires the least knowledge of Doctor Who to play off of. So I'll definitely give you that, except for the corridors gag. You know, they all look the same. Even that was kind of more of a throwaway line than anything else.
So does this one feel like Benny Hill?
Yeah. It's the most kind of Benny Hill, noises off style of British slapstick style humor. Which, again, I appreciate and enjoy, but also it's the one that's least grounded in respect for the source material they're making fun of.
And a plunger for a hand. All right. Part three. The Daleks capture the couple rather than exterminating them and tie them to a chair. Much to Emma's confusion, why is there a chair here? They've also restored the Master to his original age and augmented him with etheric beam locators. The Doctor mocks him over the sensors that resemble breast. The Master has given the Daleks the secrets to controlling Zatronic energy beam for the new bits they've given him. The Doctor learns the Dalek's real plan and farts it to the Master. The Daleks quickly figure out the Time Lords are in cahoots, but accidentally shoot the Doctor and the Zatronic generator instead. The overloading generator is beyond the Master's capability to repair. Only the Doctor can fix it. The Doctor tells Emma, "I love you," in Teresian, with the Master translating before seemingly dying. Emma is distraught at his apparent death, but the Master reassures her that the Doctor is in his ninth body and has many more lives as he begins to regenerate. End of part three.
So we almost had the opposite problem here with part three, in that aside from the fart joke, this could more or less be a Doctor Who episode, right? Yeah. And the chair gag is the other one that's there. I mean, there's a couple of gags here, but like, this is clearly Steve Moffat going, "I've always wanted to write a Doctor Who episode." You know, it feels like, you know, the Master has made a horrible plan. He's being betrayed by the Doctor, still feels a kinship to him and wants to save him. And the companion doesn't understand that death is not forever. It's compressed. It's obviously done for jokes, and it's very limited structure they have to work with. But it's, this is the one that feels the most like an actual straight up Doctor Who episode out of the four parts.
Hands down. Cause you have like your Daleks, you have their not killing the Doctor when they should have killed him. Yep. Very much a Whovian move.
Mm-hmm.
Any final comments on part three?
No, the next part is the one I have thoughts on.
Part four, the Doctor regenerates, resulting in a handsome and vain persona. He confirms that Emma is still very interested in marrying him and prepares to leave with her. Still, the Daleks beg the Doctor to help deactivate the Zatronic beam generator in exchange for his life, which he agrees is a perfect way to finish his career.
However, an explosion causes him to regenerate again, this time into a shy persona, very nervous around girls, and the master with his oddly placed etheric beam locators. Emma is visibly disheartened by his new version, finding him nowhere near as attractive as the two predecessors. He tries again to deactivate the beam, with another burst of energy causing him to regenerate yet again. The new doctor, very handsome and charming, is somewhat embarrassed that he wasted three bodies in under a minute, simply because he forgot to unplug the generator first. The crisis is over, and Emma looks forward to getting to know this new doctor when a residual burst of pure Zatronic energy knocks him down. The doctor appears to die permanently, with his Zatronic energy preventing his regeneration. The master and the Daleks resolve to forswore evil to honor the doctor's sacrifice forever. Yet, to everyone's amazement, the doctor's features change, and he regenerates, becoming a voluptuous woman. Emma, however, calls the wedding off due to the doctor being, in a very literal sense, no longer the man she fell in love with. The new doctor is quite excited to discover that her sonic screwdriver has three settings, but then she and the master lock eyes. The two express a mutual attraction, and they go off together, the master laughing maniacally and saying, "I'll explain it later."
Which this is where a lot of the running jokes kind of come to their crashing together. Like, the "I'll explain it later" is also a gag the Daleks end up using at one point in time.
And the doctor and the master both use it in earlier episodes. It's
right, right.
And it comes and back for the 10th regeneration too, where it's dropped in multiple times.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing, is like, here it is meant to be very clearly meant to be the writer didn't think of an answer for this joke, which is meta because there's no time to actually explain it. So that's why it kind of works really well. But I mean, yeah. So I mean, the real gag here is the doctor regenerates multiple times, and isn't that funny? And it actually is. hilariously, one of the regenerations is Hugh Grant, who we'll talk about again as a doctor very shortly, surprisingly enough. But also, it is the first time the doctor is regenerated as a woman, so. You know, suck on that.
No, we'll talk about, it's not Hugh Grant, it's the other one. Richard something or other. First screams of.
Right. Hmm? Yeah, Richard Grant, right, sorry.
Yeah.
I got the two Grants confused, my apologies.
I would have liked to have seen the Joanna Lumley or Hugh Grant actually do runs as the Doctor. That would have been fascinating and fun to watch.
Yeah. Which, again, is one of the things that's kind of bizarrely frustrating about this, is that, with a couple of exceptions, most of the incarnations of Doctor we see here, and even the incarnation of the Master we see here, it's like, I could see almost them playing a serious take on this.
Yeah, I could see Jonathan Pryce being the Master easily.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, yes, there are a bunch of sex jokes in it, but that's the kind of humor we're talking about here. I mean, this is very much kind of inspired by British panto, which had a lot of double entendres. So, I mean, that's par for the course of the style of humor we're talking about here and the stuff that's being done in.
And it's also 1999, I think, if memory serves.
Right, right. So
it's firmly entrenched almost, Jesus, like 25 years ago.
Right. But, I mean, again, only Doctor Who can really do a joke about regeneration and understand the audience gets it. You know, this is a lot of science fiction. I mean, prior to this, a lot of science fiction is just kind of literally insert word here, right? It's a Zatronic beam. Okay. This is kind of 50s era. Let's just put a cool sci-fi word in here and move on. But this idea of regeneration relies the audience understands how regeneration works. And specifically, again, this is comic relief. So this is going out to most of the nation, most of the kingdom, and recognize that they have to understand the joke. And they do. And that's what's so great about this, is because, again, Doctor Who's not cult television. It's not something that only a handful
of TV
fans watch. Yeah. So of course the Doctor regenerates. Of course the Master lived for hundreds of years. These are constantly, you don't have to explain for the jokes to work. And so having the Doctor change radically personalities in different ways again, it's like they've seen this happen, so they understand this is a thing that happens, and so that's not the joke. It's how are people reacting to the show, and the fact it's happening so fast, of course, is the other gag. Is like, you know, whoops, I died three times because I forgot to unplug something. It would be really dark in any other franchise, but here it's just kind of a passing joke.
And all of that then leads us up to around 2003, where we get the scream of Shalka, which stars a Ninth Doctor, which is, as you were saying, Richard E. Grant, takes over the role of being the Ninth Doctor. And this sort of became a thing where all the fans thought, you know what? It's sort of like this live motion thing. It's an animated version. We could have the Doctor. As long as we're getting Doctor Who, we don't care as much what format it's in. So they were going to go with this animated version of it, which the synopsis of the story, the Doctor materializes in a village in Lancashire. An annoyed Doctor who has apparently been transported here against his will finds a village silent. Its inhabitants are all living in fear except for barmaid Allison. The alien Shaka has taken up residence beneath the town in preparation for a wider invasion. Despite his initial reluctance, the Doctor finds himself having to save the world again, aided by Allison and an enemy who has become an ally. And that was released. Eddie, you said you watched it. What did you think of it?
It's okay. It, well, in the sense that it's done with Flash technology, so the animations are extremely stiff. It was also meant to be a web series in the original understanding of it. So like they expect to have a very small audience, but the idea was really, let's do this to see if there's an audience for this kind of stuff, right? And hilariously, it turned out that this is where I get into the BBC Worldwide versus BBC thing, is because BBC Worldwide was making this. They're like, let's make this web series, see if people are excited about it. If they are, we can maybe get some better animation, do a proper cartoon of this and franchise it worldwide. Whereas BBC Television was already making a new version of Doctor Who and just didn't tell them.
And after it was released, that's when they said, you know what? We're creating a brand new live action version. And it came out almost on the coattails of this, totally crushing any hope that people may have had for a web series, getting a lot of span speculation for years about like, what's it going to be like? Who's going to be in it? How are they going to do it? Are they going to pay it? Is it going to be the Ninth Doctor that's doing it? Or is it going to be a Tenth Doctor that takes after this one? And that was that for years.
Yeah. And for a long time, people, you know, like, is the Shalka Doctor an official Doctor? It has now panned out over the years. The answer is no. Richard E. Grant is not considered an official incarnation of the Doctor. But it was a close run thing. And honestly, it's weird because, like, why does the TV movie get a nod and Shalka doesn't? And the reality is because there was a lot of Eighth Doctor stuff after the movie. Mm-hmm. And so fans felt a connection to this character, whereas the Shalka Doctor, like you said, pretty much out of the gate was crushed. So there was no chance to get affection for him before the official thing came back. So, and that's the real reason, is like there was no emotional community engagement with this incarnation of the Doctor. So that's the real answer why. But yeah, there is a fascinating parallel universe where Richard E. Grant gets a couple of spinoff novels, maybe, or maybe a few comic book interpretations, and develops a small fan base. So it's interesting.
And that takes us right up to the door of the old New Who. But the Wilderness Years themselves were an interesting time. There was a lot of fan love that kept a show going that was actively trying to be killed by the network that brought it around. And they constantly tried to divert it, but there's so much love for Doctor Who that you can't stop it. Literally, you couldn't stop it, regardless of what they did. And the people that are going to keep fighting for it.
And so this is, I think, one of the reasons why rebooting old franchises is clearly a known quantity. And it was happening even in 2005, right? Like, it's not like Doctor Who spearheaded this. Doctor Who is in a weird boat where it's all considered to be canon because some form of Doctor Who, both officially and unofficially, was always happening. And because it was this weird clutch of forward-looking Doctor Who and backwards looking Doctor Who, is why we get this interesting 2005 and onward version of it, where it's continually looking back to the classic era and even nodding to unofficial things and that being recognized as authentic. I mean, look, it's Night of the Doctor. It was a YouTube only short with McGann in the 50th era, but it was produced by the BBC. It was shot, written, done by the official television team, and he gets to reference all of his companions that were never shown on television. Mm-hmm. So this idea of legitimizing things that were not officially canon is one of the reasons why some fans often say Doctor Who has no canon, but also why I have often argued that I think canon, too much deference to alleged canon, hurts properties, because I think if Russell T. Davies and subsequent people were super obsessed with only the television show as canon, I don't think the new version of Doctor Who would be as rich as it is. The fact is, drawing from all of these official and unofficial sources, and even like little things like the design of the Daleks in the new show, some of it stems from the Terry Nation specific Dalek stuff that never showed up on television, but Terry Nation licensed outside of Doctor Who. So things like the Emperor Dalek, those visuals never showed up in the original show. They showed up in the TV because they're referencing this licensed spinoff stuff. It does also mean that Doctor Who has one of the weird things where it has several layers of spinoff, which gets into deep in the weeds of things like I said, Benny or Iris Wildtime having their own shows or franchises, and then those also getting spinoffs from it. So you have several layers of spinoff from Doctor Who, which is wild and fascinating. But the Wilderness Years are a time that's harder for us to cover given the format of our show, but is absolutely vital to understanding what the hell Doctor Who is as a franchise.
And that's why we took the approach that we did that sort of gives little highlights of everything. So if there's pieces that people want to go and explore, they can. But I can't move on to the next bit until we at least take a moment to acknowledge that a lot of other companions were also created during the Wilderness Years. Just name like two. You've also got Evelyn Smythe and Hex, both mm-hmm. incredible companions that came out later. And you could talk about Charlie and some other people. Which leads us to Eddie. Are we finally done with Doctor Who? Is next week the wrap-up episode of Who, and we can get the fuck out of the TARDIS and go somewhere else?
No, because you may have noticed we've referenced it, but we've not really covered Big Finish, which is literally the big fish of Doctor Who tie-in media. So we're going to take a little extra time to cover Big Finish in more detail, and we're going to go back to our normal format. We're going to cover some of the Eighth Doctor audio adventures, because frankly, the love of people having the Eighth Doctor almost entirely comes from his Big Finish output.
Absolutely. And
some of the novels and whatnot, but yes, also the redemption of the Sixth Doctor as a character, and Colin Baker as an actor, a lot of that comes from Big Finish. So my contribution to this is going to be Chimes of Midnight, which is a very atmospheric early Eighth Doctor audio adventure. It's extremely cheap on Big Finish if you want to just purchase it. It's like, I think, $5. But even not, I believe the entire run is on Spotify if you want to just listen to it for free. It's a couple hours, so it's pretty short, but because these audios are also going to be structured a bit like the classic Doctor Who eras. They're going to be 4 25-minute episodes generally,
which is always amazing to get the music break in there.
Yeah.
If folks are looking to purchase your swag or to reach out to you online, where could they do that?
The best way to do that is to look for Pugsteady. That's my company, Pugsteady. That's my website. That's my social media. But also, you can find me, along with Chris, on the Darker Hue Discord, where this time I am talking about some really interesting 50s and 60s crime novels I've been discovering.
If you're looking to buy my stuff, you can go to the Darker Hue Studios website. That's where I house most of it. If you want a second edition on Unbound, you go to Chaosium's website. Like Eddie said, I am in the Discord. If for some reason you're still lurking on Twitter or whatever they want to call it now, I still have an account there. I'm also in Blue Sky. Otherwise, I guess I'll be seeing you.